You're listening to a special online exclusive episode of Panel Borders, in which comics journalist Matt Badham is talking to 2000 AD artist PJ Holden about his formative years leading up to his big break drawing Judge Dredd and his most recent projects. The interview was recorded at Oxford's Small Press Comics Festival Caption this time last year. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
All right, so the first thing is kind of your art education. I mean, the word is failure, isn't it?
Yeah, I have no formal art education.
What
at
happened
all.
There? Because I think this is quite interesting.
I was very into drawing dragons and monsters and all the sorts of things you are when you're 14 or 15 or whatever. And was told quite categorically, you're so good, you won't have to do any work to get an A. So I decided to test that theory, and it turns out I did have to do work to even get a pass, so I failed it.
So at school you failed. I mean, you're a working artist now, but you failed art.
Yeah, failed art. I was really sort of into computers and art, and I desperately wanted to marry the two of them together somehow. I couldn't figure it out. Mm. And I actually remember sitting with a careers advisor. I said, what do you want to do? I said, I love drawing, I love computers. Is there any way to... something with both of them? They kind of went...
Technical
drawing. This was 85, 86 or something. Yeah. So at that point, there was nothing. There's no way to do that. Oddly, when the iPhone and the iPhone comic stuff, part of the reason that I was kind of one of the first people to do anything on that was because it felt like suddenly there was a way to marry computers and drawing and put the two of them together. That's kind of a little thing that's always been with me, just the two of those. So I failed art O-level and then kind of went, right, well, art, who knows? Yeah. Who knows what's good or not? I put that away and just, you know, I didn't feel you could make any money from it. I didn't feel you could get any sort of job in it.
Yeah.
I was living in Belfast and 15, the idea of being a comics artist, was it with you or was it somebody else? It might have been...
I wasn't living in Belfast.
I did an interview with where I said that to me at that point the idea of being a comic
being
artist
an astronaut,
is exactly the same as being an astronaut in Belfast. You've no mission whatsoever. You might as well want to spontaneously turn into an asteroid. It was just nonsensical. So and I couldn't see how you'd make art work at all as a paying job. So I just kind of ignored it.
Yeah, this kind of dovetails in something I personally found interesting, which has come out of interviews with artists, and it's even embedded in like the language, which is this thing about realizing that it's about the graft. It seems like such a simple thing, but you know, even in the language, people say, "Oh, he can draw, he can't draw, she can draw, she can't draw." And actually, I've encountered so many artists who've told that story, or the reverse of it, where I think Matt Brooker Disraeli told me during our interview that he was just like, I wasn't the best artist in the world, but I just wanted it so much. I put the hours in. I worked myself.
Well, I've seen artist portfolios with amazing stuff in it, and then a year later you see the same artist with the same amazing stuff, and they've done nothing. And you kind of think you're not gonna work in comics. I mean, it's beautiful, but where's it going to go? If you don't finish anything, where's it going to go? I was quite flaky and lazy, but I never stopped. I went through periods where I would draw less and other periods where I would draw more and occasionally would draw a comic strip. But I always kept coming back to it like a homing pigeon. I'd come back to drawing. So my house was littered with little drawings of arms and things, but I didn't really do that much in the way of comics. But I kind of honestly feel that I'm not a particularly... I wouldn't have described myself as a particularly good artist or particularly talented, but I worked and worked and worked and kept at it. And it wasn't even a question of doing a lot of work. It's just I never stopped drawing.
But do you think that has, if you're any sort of creative, And I kind of hate that term as well, because, you know, gardening's creative, science is creative. But if you're doing anything, one of the big things psychologically you can do is realise you're just on a spectrum and you're always trying to improve.
Yeah.
But just, I mean, you had a nice little anecdote, I thought, which kind of, the other thing is the position of comics in culture, particularly at that time. Mm. The thing about your brother's art and the real art,
yeah,
and
my,
your dad's attitude.
My brother, yeah. John, was an artist, and he actually went to art college. And whereas I was doing computers and drawing, you know, occasionally drawing comics.
Drawing ninjas.
Yeah, well, notepads. Mostly Dread. If I'm honest, it was mostly Dread. I have one notepad in the house that I bought. I used to write a lot in my little thoughts in my notebooks. So I've got one drawing pad that I bought and I've kept. And it says in the top of it, this notebook was just blah, blah, blah. And I will not draw any Dread in this notebook. Halfway down the page is a drawing of Dread. So, you know, it's not that.
Something about that day stick.
It was a chin and head.
Oh, the chin.
But anyway, my brother drew and painted. And generally what he would do is he would copy pictures and he would often, you know, take little facets and he would redraw them and add a little bit of border to them. And you know, and it would be fine art, or what would people would think of as fine art. And my dad, even now, my brother has stopped drawing years ago.
This is copying painting.
Yes,
copying
artwork. It was very good copies.
Yeah.
And I do remember
been a
saying,
master forger.
I said, John, you're really well. He was
a master forger, was he?
You know, my dad's a ducking and a diving type, and you know, but you know, it's been some time since John's done any drawing. And I was talking to someone and saying, yeah, I draw comics. And my dad piped up, yeah, but John's the real artist. And I kind of going, well, you know, I've actually earned a living from my drawing. Yeah, no, yeah. John does the art. I'm going, all right, man, fair enough. Whatever.
So anyway, you're in Belfast. Obviously, you live there, mid-80s. You failed your art, you're hanging out with John McRae. But you get into the computers.
Well, yeah, I was working in computers since I was 14. So I had a placement in school and I just stayed there. And they offered me work and I stayed there. So to me, I had this job that paid relatively well, and then drawing was something I just happened to be one of those guys that drew a lot in their notepad when they were doing stuff. So it was never really, even whenever I met John, by that stage I was 18, and I felt
88, you
said. 88, yeah. I felt kind of that my pathway had been bedded in. I was a computer guy who did a bit of drawing, Yeah, so it was never really kind of realistic. I never really felt it was that realistic. And then, you know, around 18, 19, I started getting properly into girls. Not so much I got into girls, so much as, you know, I actually...
They reciprocated.
There were girls willing to go out with me.
Yeah. You know,
I'm
13, you're into girls, but they reciprocate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which meant that the day job, which was computers, stayed, and the drawing kind of went to the wayside because... It was
you had to earn
draw
a living.
A picture or snog a girl.
Right.
Girl wins for a while. At least for a while, anyway. Phil got married.
But kind of drawing at John McRae's house, who obviously probably everyone knows Hitman and DC Comics.
Yeah, well, there's
and stuff,
there's a number of cameos of me in things like what do you call it? Troubled Souls. And,
oh right.
Yeah, there's in Troubled Souls. There might be a few troubles more. It's two characters talking in a grave, and I've got a wee gravestone there with my name on it. Which is, no one's ever going to know that now because I don't think it's ever going to be recorded.
You gave Dave Bailey a cameo in the Dread, didn't you?
Yeah,
I wanted a cameo. I basically begged for a cameo.
If I'm honest,
Dave's
not here, is he? No.
No.
Have you ever met John Wagner? Have you ever seen John Wagner? John Wagner's a lovely, very tall man. He's got a lusciously dark, thrusting head of hair. I mean, it's an amazingly kind of full body of hair that he's got. And I was talking to Gordon on the phone and just suggesting that maybe it's not entirely natural. But I was, I mean, honestly, a joke. I was messing around because it is so full and luscious. And he's a man of a certain age. I thought, I can't all be his. And that's where the story about intergalactic space wigs came from.
Right.
These, a race of alien wig monsters that come to Earth and infect you. And so Gordon.
So you chose Dave because he's bald?
No. Gordon wrote the story and the main character, and it was going to be this short. The main character was this kind of a bald guy who was really head of this kind of this. Essentially, he was the constantly wins this best bald head competition,
right.
And he's always getting his dome all lacquered up because he's really cool and stuff. So I thought it'd be really funny if I made him a short, stout guy with a beautiful girl, a beautiful tall girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then I met Dave Bailey, and Dave is a short, kind of stout guy with bald hair. And I thought,
sexy,
this is my guy is just going to look exactly like you.
Right.
And that's how
so
that happened.
Jealous, you know.
Well, it wasn't.
I like Dave a lot, but if I resented him.
The next time I have to draw a tall, lanky guy, you're getting
in. Can I be decapitated or something? Or,
probably.
Oh, excellent. I'm a bit confused that you're hanging out with John McCrane. You're not seeing a pathway to making money from comics.
I was working in computers, and I had only really started drawing again when I was 18. So my artwork was... And you know, this is the thing again, when you see people go, oh, I can't draw, I can't do this. And the act of drawing comics is really simple. You sit at a drawing table and draw a comic. That's it. That's it. That's all you need. Pencil, paper, you've got a comic. You have to sit your ass down and draw it.
Mm.
And that was the magic ingredient that I lacked, was the sitting my ass down to sit and draw a comic. I would sit and draw arms and legs and hands and heads, and not necessarily even on the same body. Yeah. It would be, you know, littered around. There would be little, you know, it looked like some sort of paper-based serial killer, little elements of arms here, there, and everywhere. I was sort of obsessed with forearms for some reason. But I never kind of had the wherewithal to draw it all together into a comic. And when you see guys going, oh, I wish I could draw a comic, you kind of go, it's really easy, you just sit down and draw it. Yeah. So I lacked the application, I lacked the ability to sit and just do it.
Have you heard that Eisner anecdote about him giving advice where he says some guy comes to him and says, you know, Mr. Eisner, I'm an aspiring artist, and how do I make it in comics? And Will says, you see that line over there, and it's a portfolio cue. And he's like, yeah, Mr. Eisner. And he's just like, just be in that line in 10 years. And it kind of sums it up.
Yeah.
So how did you come back into making comics?
Well, it sort of around... I was heading towards... I'd done lots of small press things. In about 97, the internet was kind of... For the general population, the internet was starting to be seen a lot more. And things like message boards. There was a 2000 AD message board, which I'd kind of signed up to. And there were guys putting together lots of small press things. Because what you've got to remember is, at that point, Belfast is... You know, it's quite small in Belfast. I mean, it's not so much that it's small. It's that if there's a convention on, it's usually... In mainland UK, it's usually in England, or if it might be in Scotland or Wales. In either instance, it's a plane flight, you know. And at that point, there wasn't the EasyJets and the Ryanairs and there weren't hundreds of £50 flights. It was a couple global hundred quid to get over. So there weren't conventions. There was a handful of people that you knew that were doing comics. Yeah. And the practicalities, I mean, you could sit and draw a comic, but then what do you do with it once you've got it done? So you need like-minded people to be able to kind of... And also, I was always very much... I didn't really write anything of my own. I was kind of content to draw.
Right.
So I lacked having any writer friends. So, you know, there was a couple of guys that I knew, and we did some stuff. And, you know, I think the most I ever managed was 6 pages of any one strip.
Right.
I think there's a slightly charming thing happens with new people who are kind of very keen to be comic artists and have yet to do anything major, is they always start by deciding to do 100-page epics. It's the first thing they want to do. And when you meet them now, you kind of go, you realise you're not going to get beyond page 12. Because what happens is, if you get to page 6 or 7, you'll have increased your ability enough to be able to look at page 1 and go, that's a bit rubbish. I'm going to go back and redraw it.
Because Rufus Daglow sort of said, you know, he's a Tank Girl guy at the moment. He had this incredible quote, which was about, you know, you get told to take your time on art, but actually in my experience, I hope I'm not misquoting you, Rufus. Anyway, in my experience, you should go as quick as possible, because if it's not any good, you just end up polishing a turd, and you might as well get those pages out of the way. What do you think of that?
There's lots of corresponding quotes. I can't remember the exact numbers, but there's something like...
1,000 pages, isn't it?
Well, I think it was 4,000 pages was the... What do you call him? The guy who did the Cerebrus...
Dave Sim
said 4,000. Every artist has 4,000 pages of shite in them, and you've got to get rid of that before you get on.
Before you're mediocre.
Yeah. So there's
can you imagine
the first
mediocre page?
Yeah,
I'm average.
There's you can polish it up and make. I think speed helps motivation. I think if you do pages fast, then what happens is you get used to seeing things completed. And once you're used to seeing things completed, it builds the motivation to do more things.
Yeah, and so there's so many other different factors beyond just pure drawing ability.
Yeah, I suppose.
Composition, page.
Yeah, and I kind of think there's a I mean, going back to what you were saying about there's talent and then there's application of just sitting and doing the thing. There's a, I don't know if it was a study or a book that said something like any expertise is built over 10,000 hours. It's 10,000 hours of anything. Yeah. You do anything for 10,000 hours and you will be good at it. You will be expert level at the end of it. Even if you think you're rubbish at it now, you do anything for 10,000 hours. And, you know, now when somebody goes, oh, that stuff you're doing is really good, I'll often kind of go, well, I've been doing, you know, for 10 years, I've been doing stuff like that. So if it's not really good by this stage,
you might as well give
I might as well give up. I might as well stop. You know, just, if it's not be at least to a certain level, then I might as well just give up.
Just as an aside, your blog's pretty good for you. You do quite a lot of going back through work, don't you? And sort of,
I still have.
You took your first dread strip and basically gave yourself a kicking.
Yeah, I'm quite analytical. I'm quite sort of depressingly analytical. I like to break things. It's pauljholden.com.
Right. Okay.
I like to analyze things and figure out why they're working. I'm not particularly good with my hands. I can't do it with, you know, a table or a chair. But if you give me software or some artwork, I can sit and look at it and figure out what I think is not right about it, or where the balance of it should be. And I honestly don't understand things like the golden rule and the golden median and all
golden
that stuff.
The
golden ratio. I don't understand that. But I can look at a page and kind of go, well, it feels a bit unbalanced and it needs a wee bit of weight here. And the storytelling's going awry because this isn't happening.
Yeah.
I mean, my art, maybe it's a sign of my lack of any formal art training, but my ability to look at art is based almost entirely in storytelling.
So why didn't you think, I'll go and do a few courses? Or did you? Did you do live drawing?
Well, there weren't any.
Did you?
But when I failed my O-level, I came out of it thinking, well, any qualification in art is dependent on whoever it is that's marking it. Not on the artwork, not on any work you've done in the background. It's dependent entirely on who's doing the marking. Which, to me, art is so... I mean, for me, at that point, I thought art is such a subjective subject that any kind of qualification in it is meaningless.
It's funny.
Which is why computers... I mean, it could be that because I was... I enjoyed computers, I was good at computers, and the analytical set, you know, computers, there might be, if you're doing some programming, there might be half a dozen right answers to anything, but they're definitely right.
Mm.
There's definitely right answers and there's definitely wrong answers. There are better right answers and there are much worse wrong answers, but there are right and wrong. In artwork, you can't say that's definitely wrong, that artwork, although I have seen some that looks definitely wrong.
It's funny.
But even those people that did those things don't think it's definitely wrong.
When I was at university, many moons ago, I was told by one of the visual arts students that it was basically known in the department that if you wanted a good grade, you should use straight lines.
Yeah.
The lecturer would generally give you a good grade. And actually some of her paintings were up and they just look like, what's that ice cream with raspberry chocolate and what's it called? And vanilla.
Neapolitan.
They basically look like Neapolitan ice cream. And if you use straight lines.
Well, maybe that's
apocryphal.
I had friends who, my brother started an art degree and dropped out. A friend of mine did an art degree and ended up in graphic design. And both of them and a lot of other people I talked to who did art degrees essentially said, if you can justify what you've drawn, you'll get a good grade.
Right.
It's not whether it's any good or not. And at that point as well, they were shying away from fine art, they were shying away from illustration. You know, in fact, illustration didn't come into it. And comics is illustration, really. It's compounded with storytelling, but it's illustration. And I loved guys like Arthur Rackham, who was turn of the century book illustrator. I love pure illustration. Line art, stuff like that was beautiful to me. Stuff where you had, you know, representative art, even... You know, I couldn't make head nor tail of it. I just looked at it and went, that's so... I mean, I can tell when someone's drawn someone's face really well in a portrait.
Yeah.
And when they start making it about, you know, orthogonal shapes and mathematics and tilted lines and then, you know, sticking a big metal widget on the side of it, I kind of think, I don't even know what I'm looking at now. I have no idea what that is.
Yeah.
So, and that's what all art education seemed to me to be about. Yeah. It seemed to be about... purely whether the person looking at that thought it was good or not. And I know, you know, there's another guy, a brother's
friend.
But
I suppose the problem is that isn't having you just describe the experience of art, and then you try and institutionalise it.
But that's what I'm saying. That's why I never pursued an education in it, because I just felt that there was no education worth pursuing in it. You know, it seemed to me that it was always going to be subjective. If I did anything in it, if I did 2 or 3 years in college doing something, it would be about building some big wanky pyramid with with people dressed in Tesla coils. A friend of mine told me a story about at art college. There was an installation, that's in air quotes, an installation, where it was a girl in a lift masturbating. And he said, and you go up to the art college and you go through and there's the girl in the lift masturbating. And then you go out again and you're going, what does that mean? What is that? And it's all about the thing of the thing. And you think, and that just, I mean, it's certainly an extreme example of it, but that just said to me that art was really about proving, you know, talking yourself out of it. Now, I'm really now a firm believer that if I do a comic strip and I have to explain it to someone, I've failed. Right. I've really failed at what I'm doing. Right. If someone goes, I read that and I didn't really understand, I have two choices. Online, especially online, if someone sort of reviews the strip and goes, oh, well, look at that, that thing is too big, and or this happened and it didn't make any sense, I can respond to that and say, well, look, here's what you're missing. But that suggests I've failed straight away.
Yeah.
So I think maybe what I've done is kind of taken comics out of this pure art sphere and into a sort of a sphere where I can analyse them and make sense of it.
Yeah.
And that comes out of the
computer. I think maybe most artists do that.
The comics guys that I like, I mean, and I don't want to disparage any particular artist, but that there was that period in the 90s where, you know, it was all about collage work and, you know, people actually hammering bits of wood down on the artwork and then painting figures within it. And you're kind of going, it's not really about storytelling now, it's about art for the sake of art. And it seemed so self-indulgent that I just thought, just tell a story. Okay. Just tell a story and make something explode. Okay. And that'll be perfect.
But the thing, sorry to run you in there, but the thing that seems transformative for you is the internet.
Yeah.
Is this a transformative thing? Yeah. So what happened there?
I think it's because I really loved computers. I mean, I can't stress enough to you how much I loved computers. I felt completely in charge and completely in control. And because, you know, like a lot of kids, I was kind of bullied in school and stuff. And reading comics was a thing that had me picked on. I remember going home with an issue of Captain Britain. This would have been 84 or something. And, you know, meeting one of the guys from school. And, oh, so you're reading now, going Captain Britain. And he seemed interested. And don't forget, this is Belfast. I'm walking along, a Catholic boy going to a Catholic school with Captain Britain with a big Union Jack on it. So, you know, I'm already risking life and limb here. So he kind of goes, what's that? And he seemed genuinely interested. And I was quite proud of the fact that I felt Captain Britain was an intelligent comic and I felt I was reading at a...
This is the Alan Moore one.
This was the Jamie Delano comic after the Alan Moore one. And so I kind of told him about it and said it was really good. And then the slagging I got the next day was just, and it just completely mortified me, and I just put down all comics.
From everyone, he just kind of...
Everyone in my class, and I just put them down, put them away, and never looked at them again. I just couldn't cope with it. And then computer, when I was about 14, I got a computer. It was an Amstrad CPC 464, and I learned to program, typing computer programs in, and computers to me were, I was, you know, that experience proved to me that you can say something to one person when they're on their own, and when they're with people, and the reaction you get will be different.
Right, and kind of the herd mentality.
Yeah. And where they might be your friend when they're on their own, they're with a group of people, they're not your friend anymore. And whereas with a computer, it was always exactly what it was. I would type in computer programs, and I would get them wrong, and they wouldn't work. I'd figure out what it was, and then, you know, and that
taught me program.
It was very safe. And it genuinely felt left me feeling in control, and in charge, and good at something. Because the thing is, and even when even as brilliant as an artist as you might be, you will never feel that you're good enough. Whereas when you're programming, if it does the job that it's supposed to do, you'll think, I've done a good job there. So it's still very kind of something that I felt very much in charge of. So when the internet was about, and with message boards, I felt like I was in a completely safe environment. And for some reason, I'd love to be able to point to exactly what it was, but around that time, I want to get published by 2008. It went from being a kind of, you know, I'd have to spontaneously turn into a pineapple was more likely, to being, I have a set goal and I'm going to be very driven to get to that set goal.
Do you think it's about suddenly finding peers who are doing it. And they're not, you know, they're not godlike, they're not removed. They're either online or... Because certainly one of the things... Because I had a big breakout of comics, and one of the things about getting published in my own limited way as a writer was about meeting other people, human, you know, living, breathing, human people.
There's a tendency, and it happens now as well, there's a tendency online when you're in on the 2000 AD message board, no matter how bad an artist you are, as long as you draw something they like, they'll tell you you're great. And that's very, that feeds your ego to such an extent. You think, well, this is kind of cool, this is nice. But there's a weird tipping point you reach where when you're getting professionally published, they go, that guy's shite. And I don't quite know, because theoretically your quality's going like that, but somehow the opinion of you is going like this. So it's like this X point where you reach right in the middle. It's more difficult now for me, now that I'm kind of doing stuff for 2000 AD, to really take part in it. Because you're treated differently when you're professional. Yeah. You know, you can tell, you say something and the reaction you get is always different. But you know what? I like the online community. Yeah. Yes, there are people that probably I'd rather didn't come anywhere within 100 yards of me, you know, with any kind of sharp implement. But, you know, at the same time, I've made a lot of friends online. Yeah. Those guys are the fans. What you've got to be careful of is assuming they represent all of 2080 readers. Because I think the vast majority of 2080 readers read the comic out of some sort of habit and don't really care that much beyond. Have you got it in? No, I'll pick it up next time I'm in. That's the highs and lows of their
message board. It's a hardcore.
The message board are people who, you know, have maybe a lot more time on their hands than.
I mean, it's a double edged sword.
But that's
it's a double edged sword because actually, you know, having written articles for the Meg, some of them are really perceptive, and I'm not talking about what I love about creators is you get these kind of creators who, I read some writer's blog and he was talking about a review he got, and he agreed with the positive bits and disagreed with the negative bits. He said, you know, it was a good review, perceptive, apart from when they said my work was bad.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the thing that people, creators, actually find irritating about reviews is that if someone gives you a bad review, it doesn't matter if, you know, millions of other people have given you a good review.
Yeah, that's the one.
In that moment, they're right. That was their response.
Yeah.
And the message board, there are some really perceptive people on
there. There are also some dim people.
Yeah, but like you say, any group of people.
Yeah, there's the 2080 review site, which is closing down now, unfortunately. But they usually do reviews with two reviewers in it. And my favourite reviews that I get, it doesn't happen all the time, but the ones that I get where one reviewer really likes what I've done, the other one goes, that's a bit plodding and rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like those, because it shows you that they're really just one person.
Subjective.
Yeah, they're so subjective. They're one person's opinion. As long as you've done a good job in your own eyes, then, you know, you can take on board anything they say. Yeah. And if they've missed... For me, it's more important if I can read it and I realise they've misunderstood it. I mean, when I was starting out drawing comics, I used to go to my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and who... doesn't read comics at all, never read comics, I would show her a page of artwork with no dialogue on it and ask her what she thought was happening. And if she could explain what was happening, then as far as I was concerned, I'd done a decent job.
Job done, yeah.
If she didn't understand it, if I had to kind of tell her what was happening, then I, you know, in some way the artwork's failed for me.
Right.
And I can't remember if I was asked for advice online. I kind of went, well, you know, if you go to your girlfriend or your wife or whoever, or your mum or whoever it is, don't ask them what they think of your artwork, because they will go, it's brilliant. If there's someone that loves you, they'll go, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
If it's your mate who you talk to down the pub, they'll go, it's shite. It's sort of, you'll not get genuine opinions. If you ask them, tell me what you think is happening, they will be able to tell you what they think is happening. And if it's wrong, on the basis of the story, then you've done it wrong.
Plus, it's also about the type of advice, isn't it? Because if someone just says, that's boring.
Yeah, what does that
you
mean?
You know, why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Just, so you're on to 2000 AD. You got Dread straight away. How did you get that? Was that a bit weird? You know, not a future shock, but Dread.
Well, first of all, you've got to understand that 2000 AD... It eats Dread for breakfast. There is a Dread in 2080 every single week, no matter what else there is. Which means, perversely, that dread is the one thing that needs filler artists, you know, more than Future Shocks do, because there are a handful of Future Shocks in a year. Mm. So there's a handful of opportunities for artists to get in a Future Shock. On the other hand, dread's always in there. And the other sad reality of it is that unless you're doing a John Wagner thing, they'll mostly ignore you. So, you know, unless you're doing some sort of John Wagner-based dread, they'll, even if you've done a brilliant, you know, one-episode filler, they'll go, yeah, that was all right, but, you know, next week Wagner's back on, that'll be great. Yeah. So they're going to ignore you for the most part. So 2080 can afford to put a filler artist on there. And what actually happened in those circumstances was it was around 2000. I had spent a couple of years doing small press stuff. I'd got to know Gordon Rennie quite well. Mm. And Gordon had been pushing my work.
He's writing dreads. He's kind of writer B.
Yeah. I was still going through. I don't know how many people have seen my artwork, but my artwork has a tendency to... When I get a script, I start reading it, and then I start drawing it in a way that feels natural and right for the script. And I often am surprised myself if it looks different from the last thing I did. And it often does.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. It just comes out like that. Yeah. Like I did the War comic Happy Valley, which was drawn this very scratchy, inky art style designed to sort of evoke a World War II film effect. And then at the same time, I did a 2080 magazine story called, what was it called? It was about a robot, Soviet
Tales
robot.
Tales of the Black Museum.
Tales of the Black Museum, which was drawn in
a
very
solid...
These are one-off
kind of Crypt Keeper EC type
and
horror
this,
story thing.
Yeah, this was about a Soviet war robot, which I drew in a very cartoony black and white art style with a single spot colour. And it couldn't have looked any more different.
Mm.
And yet it was drawn in the middle of me drawing the war story stuff. And it was the art style that seemed to fit. It wasn't kind of, you know, I have to draw this in a completely different art style, just what came out. But in 99, I decided, right, I'm going to break 2000. I want to break it before the year 2000 because it's 2080. It's the year 2000. I'll be 30 in the year 2000.
Right.
And if I've not been published by 2080 at the age of 30, I might as well just, you know, I'd forget about it. And what I discovered as well was that like
if
the
you're
drawn,
over 30 and you're listening to this, that's nonsense.
No, that is nonsense. That is nonsense.
That is ageist nonsense.
But what you've got to remember is you know,
ageist nonsense.
When I was seven and got the first 2080 and saw the year 2000, I went, my God, I'll be 30 in the year.
Jetpacks.
That's so far away. I'll be 30. And so it was a significant.
Yeah, I know
it was
what
significant
you mean.
For all those reasons. But what I discovered is when I really set my mind to a particular thing like that, and go for it, that it happens.
Right.
It's not even a, you know, it's generally when I think I want something, I don't really want something. I think I do, but I don't really. But when I really want something, I get it. And it comes to me and I will do anything to get to it. So I had been working away and I found a new job, which was part-time, which allowed me to do the computers and spend a lot of time drawing. I'd done stuff with Gordon and I kept sending him artwork and he kept putting it in front of Andy, but I was changing my art styles a lot, so sometimes I'd send him stuff and he'd go, that's a bit shite, your last thing was great and this is rubbish. I don't know what to do then. I'm not even going to bother Andy. But there was the first Dreadcon was 2000, so it was the first Dreadcon. It was
this
year
was
2000.
A special 2080 convention
So it was a lot of kind of factors.
It was in a pub.
Yeah, most conventions are
pub
in some way. And I went over, met Andy, and because he'd seen a lot of my stuff online, he'd already. I had a big. I did everything you're not supposed to do. I mean, if somebody says to me, "What should you bring to an art review?" I'll go about 6 pages at most. Don't bring any more than that because what happens is, even you know. An editor, even if you've got them fresh first thing in the morning, there's still a fatigue after 5 or 6 pages.
Yeah.
They won't. They just kind of tire. And so any more than that's crazy. So I bought a portfolio filled with everything.
Right.
And really what I wanted to try and do was go, look, okay, I'm not good enough yet, but look, I've been getting better. I've definitely been getting better. But he'd seen a lot of it online and he had already kind of gone, yeah, I'll give you some work. And I was like going, oh, okay then, right. Okay. So I went back smiling, so big a grin that my cheeks hurt for the next day, next 2 or 3 days. I emailed Gordon, said, and he's giving me some work. He went, oh, I've got a dread. I've just done a filler dread. I'll tell him. I'll say, do you want to give it to you? And that's what happened. That's how I got my first dread.
Yeah.
And what then happened was I got the script. So what's the deadline? And he went, oh, just whenever. I went, okay then. Which, I mean, that's just going to go in a drawer. So I just started drawing it and drawing it. And I think I drew the first page 6 or 7 times.
Didn't you offer to redraw it?
No, I did redraw it.
Ropey.
I sent it to him. I said, there you go, Donny. He said, yeah. And even now, if you say to Andy, he'll go, yeah, it's maybe not something I should have said. But I said, what do you think? And I'm all like, what do you think?
Excited,
and he went, I've seen better dreads. And now when I think about it, I think, well, you know, to be fair, I've seen Carlos Esquerra dreads. And, you know, I've seen better dreads is not much of an insult,
it's in
really.
In the line of that criticism we were talking about earlier from a professional editor.
Yeah.
The rubbish criticism.
Yeah, it is a bit cack. So so I kind of went, well, I went, I'll redraw it. He went, no, it's fine. I'll print it. And I said, no, I'll redraw it. He says, why? I says, well, look, if you print it and it's rubbish, you'll probably not give me any more work. But if I redraw it, and even if it's better, even if it's only a wee bit better, you'll go, well, at least, you know. And he went, yeah, I suppose that's true.
Okay.
So, because the thing is, I'd already decided in my head that 2080 cannot afford to nursemaid artists or writers. That's the big thing. If you do something and you're a bit rubbish and they've paid for it, they'll run it, but they're never going to ask you to do anything else.
Yeah.
You know, why would they? The last thing he did was shite.
Particularly if you talk to what I've found, I'd really like to kind of investigate this further, because talking to some editors who worked in the 80s and the early 90s, there seemed to be more of an interventionist culture where they would take a writer and rewrite the scripts and mould things. And now it seems, I think it's probably about time and cuts in publishing and technology.
Yeah, I think
they just
is.
Need that thing to be as ready as it can be.
Yeah. But also, at that point, there wasn't much in the way of a kind of apprentice. Well, there wasn't a proper apprenticeship system in those days. And I know Chris Weston did like an artist apprenticeship, effectively.
Yeah, with Don Lawrence. Yeah.
But now the apprenticeship is small press. I mean, you do you do a lot of small press stuff, and by the end of it, you'll know how to put a script together. You've been edited 6 times. You know, you've been published. You've seen what reaction is like. You've seen how to fix things. So the small press acts as the apprenticeships, as were.
So for the last 10 years, I mean, you've pretty much done everything. Like we said at the beginning, you've done humor comics. You've done Image, you've done 2000 AD, you've worked for Dynamite doing Happy Valley with Garth Ennis. What have I missed out? You did Warhammer.
I did a lot of small press stuff as well.
Yeah.
While I was
so,
doing all of that.
Doing creator own stuff and doing work for hire. Do you want to talk about the rationale behind and the comics culture in general?
I'm doing right
or
now.
Or should I not have brought it up?
No. Right now I'm doing a creator own thing that's actually going to be published by 2080 in the magazine.
Can you? Yeah, we'll just.
I don't want to talk anymore because it's not going to be for a while yet anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
My feeling is that if you want a long sustained comic book career, because everyone's desperate to work for Marvel, you know, I mean, to Marvel or DC, but if you want a comic career, if you talk to someone who goes, I want to earn money for a living, you have to work for Marvel or DC.
They said to me, you know,
yeah,
do Power Pack, yes,
yeah, of course.
Come on.
But you look at all the
Give
guys,
me Power Pack.
You look at guys like Jonathan Hickman and the guy that did Sweet Tooth, and you know, those guys that did little quirky, and Kieran Gillen, and those guys that did little quirky books. The reality is, those books don't earn any money.
Yeah.
If they want to make money, they've got to work for Marvel or DC.
Yeah.
The problem is, then you go to work for Marvel or DC, and then that becomes your career. It becomes the thing that you do. You write or you draw Superman
work
or whatever.
For hire
work
for hire is what
you said. It's work for hire. Work.
Whether it's DC or Marvel.
Yeah,
you know.
And at the end of your career, you've made a decent amount of money. You've been able to live a happy life, and it's great. But I know a lot of artists that you know, they've done comics for enough years that now they're kind of going, I hate comics. I hate comics. And they feel like they're sort of stuck in this, I'm doing comics because that's what I do. I have no escape route. I think a lot of it's to do with the fact that they're doing work for hire and they don't own anything. You know, if you have a brilliantly long, sustained career doing stuff for Marvel, at the end of that career, all of that stuff belongs to Marvel. There's nothing of it's yours. And I kind of think that any comic career needs to have, you know, maybe it's 2-to-1 ratio. Maybe you need to do 2 creator own or 2 page rate things for every 1 creator own thing. But I do think you need to, you know, have some sort of creator own thing, even if it makes you no money.
Right.
You know, and frequently it makes you no money.
We kind of glossed over the last 10 years a bit, but I think that's okay.
I drew a lot of dread.
Someone
drew some Road Trooper.
Someone could go through that part of your career and go through it. And I want there to be space in case there are questions or there's not, and we can go and have a drink.
Yeah. But and just to this bring it, so let's skip the whole 2080 thing. I've done, right now I'm doing two creator-owned things. One's for 2080, one's for another publisher, and it's an album. And I'm doing a page rate thing, and it is for Strip Magazine, the UK.
Can you mention your webcomic?
Oh, and I'm doing a little webcomic experiment, but I'm sure we'll talk about it in the webcomic. With a writer called James Moran. I don't know if you know, do you know James Moran?
He's a Torchwood guy in Severance, the film. Yeah.
I posted on Twitter, really fancy doing a webcomic. Don't want
you
to write
thought,
it,
you
though.
You thought, like, Dave from Burnley was going to come.
No, I had two or three friends of mine came. I'll do it, I'll do it.
And then James Moran came and you
And James
you
Moran said, I would like to do it with you. No, the plan is to do, what I wanted to do was a one-month experiment. I'm going to do a one-month webcomic where it'll be a strip a day for every day. I need a writer. And James kind of went, I'll do it. And we kind of batted back and forth some stuff. And it's going to open with one full page in colour, and then there'll be lots of black and white strips. So I've done the first page. I have to colour it and letter it yet. But what I did a webcomic called, what was it called? It was for spinechillers.com.
Oh, really?
And they contacted me and said, do you want to do a webcomic on one page? I went, yeah, sure. And they sent me the script and I banged it out in an hour. I thought, this is great. It's like, in 1 hour to do a page of artwork? Brilliant. I could do this all day.
Well, why did you bang it out in an hour?
Because first of all, most webcomics are headshots, medium headshots.
Right.
It just seems to be the format. This script certainly was medium headshots because a lot of it relies on dialogue.
Yeah.
So it tends to be medium headshots. It's quite restrictive in its physical size, so you don't need to draw big pages. And I mean, the hardest part of drawing comics, I find, is the figuring out the layout and the choreography of what's happening.
Right.
You know, a fight scene with Dredd and three monsters is a lot more complicated to choreograph than three people chatting over six pages. Even if the fight scene happens on four panels, there's a lot of choreography to work out, a lot of figuring things out, and you know, and how to do that, and or you know, when I did the battlefields, there was a dog fights, so you're figuring out ways to show planes relative to the shapes of panels. So you've got the storytelling between the panels, and then you've got to figure out how to make sure people understand which plane and the direction of the plane. And so it's a lot of it's choreography, a lot of it's figuring that choreography out. And webcomics don't have that problem. They are literally, guy one says this, guy two says that, and the joke is in the dialogue. So, and if I'm honest, you could do it with stick figures. You don't really need to be
able to
draw.
So I could have a job.
You could have a job, yes. If
I
you
could
do
be
that
a famous web
pages,
cartoonist.
You could be. Well, there is one.
I don't want to do the 50 pages.
XCD is a stick comic, web comic. It's all stick figures. I kind of figured I can bang those out. You know, if I get a script, I can bang those out. And, you know, the thing is, you sort of, I mean, I have about 1,300 followers. The thing that I've discovered about comic writers is that there is never enough work for them. They want to do stuff.
Yeah.
Their problem is they can never find an artist.
Yeah.
If you're an artist and you walk into, if this room was filled with comic writers and you walked in and had a portfolio of decent work and said, I love working for free, you would be torn apart. There would not be anything left of you. You know,
I've got this image
of a feeding
frenzy. A writer running home with the drawing arm.
Yeah.
Going, I've got it! I don't need the rest!
It's a weird thing.
Animated by electricity.
in the small press, it seems to be that the writers are vastly outnumber artists. And then when you get into professional work, it's the other way around. There's a very small number of writers and a large number of artists in it. It's a weird thing. I've never quite understood.
It's got to be like that, though, because the writers have to write more to make a living.
Well, that might be it.
And
I mean,
time as well,
you
because
kind of,
being an artist is such a laborious process.
It does seem an odd thing that somehow that more of the artists break through than the writers. And you kind of wonder, maybe it's easier to delude yourself as a writer than it is to delude yourself as an artist.
What a lovely place to leave it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For more info about PJ's work, please go to www.pauljholden.com. And for Matt Badham's interviews and writing, check out his blog at matthewbadham.com. pj.wordpress.com. PJ's tremendous serialized comic strip Number Cruncher, about time travel and reincarnation, written by novelist Cy Spurrier, is currently on its penultimate installment in Judge Dredd magazine, which is also a place to find interviews by Matt Badham, and can be found in most high street newsagents. The interview you've just heard was recorded at Caption, Oxford's Small Press Festival, which is taking place again this weekend, the 6th and 7th of August, at the East Oxford Community Centre, and guests include Al Davison, Ian Culbard, Kate Brown, Paul Rainey, David O'Connell, and Paul Duffield. Tickets are a very reasonable £5 per day, and you can find more info at www.caption.org. If you can't make it to Oxford on Saturday, at Gosh Comics, in their shiny new shop at No. 1 Berwick Street in Soho, Dave McKean is doing a signing of his new graphic novel Celluloid from 2 to 4pm, which also marks the start of an exhibition of his work at the venue. And on the following Saturday, the 13th of August, acclaimed indie comic book artist Luke Pearson will be launching his new title Everything We Miss from 6pm. More info about both events can be found at www.goshlondon.com. The weekend after that, Friday the 19th and Saturday the 20th of August, there's a two-day war comics festival at the Imperial War Museum in Lambeth. Friday the 19th starts as an academic conference, including presentations by Paul Gravett, Roger Sabin and Tim Pilcher, followed by an hour-long chat on stage by Pat Mills talking about his work. Pat Mills' talk is available as a separate ticket to the conference or included in the price of the whole day. Then on Saturday the 20th, there are a variety of individually ticketed events, including talks by David Collier, author of Chemo, who will also be doing a separate comics-making masterclass, Garth Ennis, who is chatting about his work in a rare UK Comics Festival appearance, and panels including the creators of Dougie's War and War the Human Cost talking about their publications, plus a free film screening at the end of the day. More info about all the above can be found at www.panelborders.com/events. An additional 10-minute interview by Matt Badham with PJ Holden can be found in this week's regular episode of Panel Borders, broadcast at 5pm on Resonance 104.4 FM in London on Thursday the 4th of August, with an extended podcast online at www.panelborders.wordpress.com after transmission. And that show is the first of a series of episodes about comic book shops, and also includes interviews with two comic book creators, Al Davison and Will Morgan, who also run comic shops in Coventry and Putney respectively, but come to Caption in Oxford to sell a selection of their range. Panel Borders was recorded, introduced and edited by Alex Fitch, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.